Why did God foster and allow the competitive spirit that led to fratricide? Giddy, what do you say?
To show that
people and what's not there. Yeah. I think that what Cain needed at that time was to read Sefer Koheles and to understand, Cain, the world's not fair. Brush yourself off, and get up again, and get back in the ring. Alright? Shavu Yipol Tzadik V'Kam, you're on the floor now. If you feel angry, you feel depressed, get back in the game. You can win. I'm giving you a pep talk. Couldn't we imagine God telling him something that would surely have prevented this fratricide? Yes, but that's the bread of shame. God could have told him, yes, Cain, I'm giving you whatever I gave to Hevel. You're the man. You're even better than Hevel. But God doesn't work that way. And parents shouldn't either. And teachers shouldn't either. Don't give free rides. Free rides make it worse afterwards. If you hear all those terrible stories about these guys, impoverished people who have won millions of dollars in the lottery, and they end up being 3 years later, they question, where are all these guys? 3 years later, they're in jail, they're worse off. All right? I'm not saying it has to be that way. I'm just saying is that when we give free rides, it doesn't end up good. Right? We have to ask ourselves if the free rides of the great society has served the people it was meant to serve. Right? And it's the same story as the Meraglim in the desert. They got so used to the free ride in the desert, they couldn't imagine anything but that kind of life. So Israel was off the charts for them. Especially since there are challenges there with the people who live there, the giants and everything else. So remember the three mitzvahs they got afterwards. We did that in the Moshe class. Challah, libations, and tzitzis, to cover for the three things you think that you can't deserve on your own. Yes, you can. You can deserve the anonim that will leave when you get to Israel with the tzitzis. You can deserve the pe'er when you leave. That's with the libations. And you can deserve the mun that's going to stop when you leave this place with your achal. Okay? Why did God create us only to destroy us? Why bother creating us if you're going to make a flood?
He didn't. Right? He gave us free will. We just chose the wrong decisions.
Okay. Yeah, it's the same. Rashi brings this out in his Perush Al Torah. He says that you know, when you have a child, you make a kiddush, even though you know, hopefully shortly after you leave this earth, that child is going to leave the earth, and one day people are going to be crying over this birth. Well, actually, death. Right? It means that at the time God gave us the free will to make this work. Right? Now he won't just utterly destroy us like that again, but the message of the flood, right, is that we should be living with the threat of some kind of deterrence to our unbridled free will. Okay? Now, there's something akin to the flood that manifests itself in other places in the Torah. The destruction of Sodom is similar, right? But there's a very interesting thing, I didn't raise this at the time, but a very interesting thing about the beginning of Shmos using imagery is very similar to Noah making the ark of a boy's mother preparing to put him in water to save his life. That imagery I submit to you here, it's more the topic of what I do in my class called Biblical Narrative, but which I haven't taught for a while, but it's more akin, it's akin to teaching us that what this woman is doing is saving the world every bit as much as what Noah did in Parshas Noah. Right? Because right now the world is devolving into half humans, half animals. Right? Half beasts of burden. And if not for this one person who's being saved in this ark, this miniature ark, you get it? Right? The world would have to be destroyed if this would continue. Okay? Three. What did God find wrong with the Tower of Babel? So we did the whole perek then, the whole story. The forced equality. I think I told you at the time, it's really very, very, it's an excellent little piece by Nechama Leibowitz's brother, Yeshayahu Leibowitz. He has now it's a three-volume work called Notes on the Parsha. Yishaya Leibowitz used to have a Parsha program on the radio in Israel every Thursday night, 20 minutes on the Parsha. And after a few years of doing this, the Divrei Torah were transcribed into this book. Right? It's really a worthwhile study. They had it at this pharmacy. So it's called Notes on the Parsha. And I don't know if you know his politics. His politics was way off crazy. He was in favor of bombing the Kotel because he thought it's Avodah Zarah. I mean, he was really crazy. He was very critical of the Israeli army. He was very, very critical of right-wing policies. And, you know, some of what he did was, but his Torah was very often sweet. And what he writes on Migdal Bavel is meant to be like a critique of communism. And right? Remember, the way I presented to you the Cain and Hevel situation vis-a-vis the Migdal Bavel situation was that we have to find some kind of medium between the competition, the competitive spirit that the Torah wants to foster, because we are a meritocracy, right? You know what a meritocracy is, right? Okay, that's what a classroom is it not? I heard a teacher recently at Berkeley on a class where the class was on different political theories. So the teacher, you know, noticed that the students were all like, you know, wearing their Shea t-shirts and they're all, you know, quality and the like. So the teacher announced that after the midterms, he saw that about 30% of the class got over 90, 20% got over 80, 20% got over 70, and 20% got over 60, and 10% failed. And he said that he's going to redistribute the points on the exam, and he's going to have to shave off some points, 5 to 10 points from the 90 group, to help the failing students be boosted up to at least a C. And he presented that to them, and they didn't like it one bit. You get the point? It's communism. So, you have to level the playing field. He goes, wait a second, the class is a meritocracy. So he says, why? You don't want the outside world to be a meritocracy. We have to level the playing field and by all means, competition brings out very good products, but sometimes very bad things in people. Right? Look at Cain and Hevel. So we have to balance our competitive spirit with our cooperative spirit. Right? And the Torah does that. The Torah gives us many mitzvahs that tries to inculcate what we call vatranut. Remember that? Vatranut means levater, right? Means to be magnanimous, to give up. Right? If I'm going to lend you $1,000, why shouldn't I get a piece of your action? Right? Now, if you're using my $1,000 to make money, yeah, you can do something. We can invest together. It's called a heter iska. But to loan you $1,000 for 6 months and all I get back is $1,000 when I could have used that $1,000 to make money, that's vatranut. I have to let my land lie fallow. I don't open my store on Shabbos, right? I give lekach shikhan peah. I give tithes. I give challah. I give rachis hagaz. I give zrobel chalayim v'keba. I give chazev v'shok. I'm all everywhere I turn. I'm giving up stuff, right? I pay money for my firstborn son. I give up my firstborn animal. Come on, how much do I have to give up here? The answer is, the two things here. It's important to give these things up because there's a person on the other end who needs it, right? But there's another thing. I need to inculcate within you a sense of vatranut. So it strikes down the competitive spirit in you that maybe should make you want to kill somebody. Right? Okay. So that's what's wrong with the Tower of Babel. And it's also similar. Remember a Medrash I mentioned about Sodom? About Sodom, that they would lie down someone on a rack, and if he was too tall, they'd cut off his feet. And if he was too short, they'd stretch him out until he's the right size. It just means that they wanted everybody to be the same. And if you come in from outside, you're likely not to be the same, right? So that's why they were very much against visitors. How did Lot get in there? Remember, they said, here is someone we allowed to come in, and now he's judging us? We're going to harm you more than them. And they would have, if not for the angels blinding them, right? Why did they allow Lot? Because he was loaded. He came in very wealthy. Got it? And he might have had a reputation of being related to this great patriarch here, patriarchal figure here, right? Whatever it is, he made his way in there. They allowed him in. But don't judge us, right? What is Avram's expectation of God? Can you articulate it? What is Avram's expectation of God? Say it in Hebrew. Hashofet kol haaretz lo yaseh mishpat. Hashofet kol haaretz lo yaseh mishpat. What's especially galling about that statement is that, you know, God can say to Avram, who are you to tell me what mishpat is? This proves, you know, the famous question that Socrates asks. Is this bad because the gods say it's bad? Or do the gods say it's bad because it's bad? You know what I'm saying? In other words, even an avowed atheist like Bertrand Russell's thought, there must be something more to evil than just that I don't like it. Otherwise, everyone will have his own position of what defines evil. Right? The Nazis spent a lot of time convincing people to do things that were unprecedented in human history. There was lots of deterrence involved. There was lots of coercion involved, but. Which made my father once say that there's very little room for the non-Jewish world between heroism and villainy. You know what I'm saying? You're either a hero or you're a villain. So there wasn't much room in between them. You get the point? For the Poles. For the Germans, if a German was found keeping a Jew in his basement throughout the whole war, he might lose his job. Might make him walk with a placard that says, I love Jews. They didn't kill Germans for helping Jews. They killed Poles and Romanians and Hungarians for helping Jews. All too often, you know, those people were all too excited to give a hand. Right? And woe betide any Jew dared go back to his house after the war was over and found out he'd lost every sibling, both parents, but at least let me try to go back to my house and get my tefillin or get a picture or two or something. Right? Get a plate, maybe something to remind myself. They'd kill you. My father was advised, don't go up to the house. They will kill you for it. And say you tried to steal what's not yours. I know of some people who even went back recently, like in the 80s, 90s, back to the house, and they saw the dishes they remember. They saw the furniture they remember. And they just asked, can I have a little bit, just a reminder? Can I have something? And they wouldn't, get out of this house or we'll kill you. This house has been in my family for 200 years, you're lying. So what's our expectation of God? Mishpat? Where's the Mishpat? All right, well, obviously here, God is the one destroying Sodom. So God, if you're about to destroy Sodom, so I have a deal with you. Don't kill the tzaddikim with the Rishayim. That's their opening statement of Avram. Right? They're sitting at the table, they're playing poker, and Avram's opening bid is, don't ha'af tispet tzaddikim Russia. That's his opening line. Afti spet tzaddik in Russia. So Hashem says, okay, Avram, I call your bluff. You're bluffing, right? I'm in. I will not kill the tzaddik with the Russia. I will let the tzaddik out. No tzaddik shall die in Sodom. Right? And that ends up what's happening, right? So then Avram says, wait a second. Avram changes the direction, remember? he starts asking not only for the tzaddik, he starts asking for the Russian. Maybe there are 50 tzaddikim in that place. Won't you let everybody live if there are 50? What's the svara? Remember we did like a whole story with Rabbi Eliezer and Koheles. Chamishim tzaddikim besocha ir. Maybe there are 50 righteous. Remember that? So maybe there are 50 righteous people in... Why do they have to say besocha ir? Ulai yesh chamishim tzaddikim sham. Ulai yesh chamishim tzaddikim bestom. Right. So it goes all the way down to 10. But Avram knew if there's less than 10, it's not going to work. There's no way less than 10 people could turn things around in Sodom. I wouldn't want it to be. So of course, there weren't 10 people, but whoever was at Tzadik, Lot and his two daughters, did get to leave. His wife longed for the past, so she looked back, and it wasn't going to work.
Right?
He asked his sons-in-law to come. It says in the Pasuk, and they mocked him. They said, but those two daughters, it says, Lokhei
Benosav.
I'm Staminat. Whoever got to go. You know, it was a tzaddik. Because Hashem said, I'll let all no tzaddik shall die. But he didn't need 10 tzaddikim for the tzaddikim to be saved. No. Whoever's a tzaddik is going to get to go.
Was Lot considered himself
in here? Maybe, but he wasn't 10.
Right.
He was, because he did take the people in. I don't know if he was influential or not. Maybe not. I don't know. We'll never know that. Right? Okay, so Avram's expectation of God is as follows. I can answer it in one sentence. Is that I deserve to have a seat at the table in the discussion of what you think is Mishpat. And God goes along with it, because instead of saying something like, you puny little human, how dare you tell me what Mishpat is, God allows Avram to have some sway. And Moshe gets in on it too. Okay? What is God's relationship to his prophets, and how are they conduits to the people receiving his message? His should have been capitalized at the end, but his could be Moshe's message, the people receiving the message of the prophet. But okay, why is that? Why Shmos 3, 4, and 5? Is because God tells the prophet here, listen, I have a mission for you. Right? Would you imagine if God comes to you in a vision and you're pretty sure it's God, you haven't taken a hallucinogen recently, and you start, you see God tells you, I want you to go do this. Go to Israel and enact my message. I want you to go to the Knesset and give this message. This is what they need to hear in Israel. The first question is going to be, why me, probably? Like Moshe. Then you're going to start to wonder, where am I going to have this? If God gives him a staff, okay. Moshe puts God back 5 times. But God tells him, and this is the point of this question, is that it's not going to be smooth. It's very rarely smooth without any glitches when I ask a human being to do something. Think of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Rootlessness, wandering, barren wives, squabbling children. Right? Not so simple, this human endeavor. Right? So, God asks human beings to give my message across because I choose to walk in the darkness. They don't see me. I don't show my open hand. Every time something that happens that could be construed as coming from me, I shouldn't say every time, but most times, I will leave it in the heart of an arrogant and stubborn man to think that it's not me. Sound like Paro? Okay. Right. Okay, it's time already, I guess. All right, so we'll continue. I just want to review all the questions next time. And just remind me, Giddy, to... what do I have to do here? Press home? Okay, remind me at the beginning of next class not to...